This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author, filmmaker, and frequent traveler to Cuba, Saul Landau.
It's the 50th anniversary of probably the most important revolution in this hemisphere in the last 100 years, the Cuban Revolution. Hear Saul give a first-hand view of its gains and its losses.
Eight alleged leaders of the RNC Welcoming Committee have been charged under the Minnesota version of the Patriot Act and face 7.5 years in prison.
They've been charged with terrorism. Since when, in this country, does dissent equal terrorism?
We'll also hear excerpts from a New York University Law School event titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era.
Stay with us. So, Michael, now we have the inauguration coming up on the 20th. A lot of people are very excited. They expect millions of people in Washington. Of course, there's apparently a no demonstration rule because I met some of my friends from Witness Against Torture who are going to be there, and they said you can't get within 40 blocks is the perimeter. Anyway, that's not just an aside. That's serious. But what I think a lot of people were surprised by, in a way, although I'm not sure they should have been, but surprised by, that Obama's team, and Obama obviously approved it, has chosen a man named Rick Warren to do the invocation, which is, I think, the opening of the entire, whole business for the inauguration. So, Michael, why were people, you think, surprised by it? Who is Rick Warren?
Rick Warren is right-wing evangelical preacher, head of a mega church called Saddleback Church out in Orange County in Southern California, not far from the John Wayne Airport. He's a big teddy bear of a guy, and he's figured out that he should present himself kind of in a velvet glove. He's not the bad guy on the right coming out of the church like James Dobson. He's the more lovable type.
But he's positive on social issues. Well, let's say
he's
a little positive apparently on the HIV issue.
Well, yeah,
on poverty.
He goes over to Africa. He tries to convert people to Christianity. He says he's in support of AIDS, but there's no way to really tell how much effect his AIDS program has had. And he preaches abstinence as how to avoid AIDS. So the guy's not even a mixed blessing as far as I'm concerned.
What don't we like about this guy?
Well, I don't like two things. One is I don't think that a religious person of any denomination has any business opening up the inauguration. There should be separation of church and state. It's a violation of that from Jump Street to put this guy up there to have him put Obama's hand on the Bible. But secondly, the guy is viciously anti-gay. He was in the leadership of supporting Proposition 8 to stop gay marriage in California.
What's interesting about that is, of course, Obama also said he opposed gay marriage. I don't think Obama went as far as to say he supported Proposition 8. I think the problem is that Rick Warren went out on a real limb on Proposition 8. He really fought for it.
He fought for it. He says that homosexuals compares them to pederasts, people who practice incest, that abortions are a new Holocaust.
Well, that's the second issue, the abortion issue. But let's stay on gay issue for a sec. Has there been a lot of opposition on this issue?
I was surprised that more people didn't oppose Obama when he appointed all the financial crooks to key positions in the economy. And I was surprised when more people didn't oppose him when he reappointed Gates, Secretary of Defense, and all the war criminals to stay in there. But this one seems to have really hit a raw nerve.
And you know what's amazing to me about this issue, which is I want to stay on it for a second, is I just came back from seeing the film Milk, which is, of course, the story of the gay activist who became a supervisor in San Francisco and eventually was murdered. He really led the struggle in San Francisco and arguably throughout the country for gay rights. And you see it was such an incredible film in terms of a human rights struggle, and that people before that were committing suicide, hiding from their parents, and it was major. And now you see this. We think we've gone forward, and what do we see? We see someone doing the invocation who opposes gay marriage, and worse, was a big fighter for Proposition 8. And what I object to, it's not just, the big tent and all that BS that we hear about Obama and bringing in other factions. That's one thing to talk to them. It's another thing to have them do the invocation at the inauguration. And particularly, here is a black president. And, the history of blacks in this country is discrimination. It goes back to the anti-miscegenation laws, which prohibited blacks from marrying whites from marrying blacks.
Which has only recently been outlawed.
20, 30 years ago, Loving v. Virginia was the final case. And so you think, shouldn't gay marriage be seen in that context? And, well, and sadly, it isn't.
No, you'd hope so. And the other fear is, and it's a very real fear, that condoning this kind of gay bashing and putting that teddy bear up there is going to increase violence against gays.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Michael. And it encourages the anti-gay marriage stuff. Rick Warren also opposes abortion. Now, what's extraordinary about that, you know, we're having a discussion in the country and everybody's debating this, and a lot of people say, okay, well, we don't like abortion, all this. What in some way really makes my skin crawl, abortion is a constitutional right.
Exactly.
73 or 76, constitutional right. And since when do you put people up in front of the entire nation at the invocation to the presidency inauguration who opposes a fundamental constitutional right, in my view, but a constitutional right?
Yeah. Well, I think that Obama figures that progressive people have no place else to go, so I can urinate on him. The answer to that is, you know, if you've seen enough, or maybe in the future you'll see enough, maybe we'll establish some place for us to go, and it won't be with some teddy bear of a gay-bashing preacher. I just wanted to segue from Protestant fundamentalism into Catholicism, because we had the relatively new pope. He made a statement against homosexuality, equating it with ecological disaster, that it's going to ruin humanity just like global warming. Deconstruct that one for me, Michael.
Well, I mean, the pope should at least, whatever their, quote, religious beliefs are, should at least be tolerant of what other people are or what they become. I mean, that's what's really shocking. And to equate that with something that's going to essentially destroy the earth, which is global warming, to equate homosexuality or being gay or lesbian with that is so off the wall that if there was a way to impeach the pope, we ought to do it. But again, Michael, as you said, think about this. Think about what you said about Rick Warren and how it's going to increase gay bashing, gay murders, gay harassment. Here you have the highest Catholic official, how many billions, a billion and a half or 2 billion Catholics, saying basically they're going to destroy the earth. So like they say about abortion, like some Catholics say about abortion, I have a right to, like, they're murdering people, I have a right to kill them. Think about that.
Well, that's a logical conclusion. And one of these fanatics went out and shot a doctor who afforded women the right to choose. That's the logic of the Pope's position.
That's the Slepian case in New York.
That's the logic of Rick Warren's position.
Yeah, so it's a pretty sad day for gay rights combined with the inauguration, the invocation, Obama and the Pope. Not a great time here when there were such gains made. And after a film like Milk comes out and you just see how extraordinary the movement is in this country for rights for gays.
No, it's a wonderful, liberating thing. I remember when we were growing up in the 50s, how deep in the closet everybody was and how horribly repressive things were. In 50 years, to have this all turned around, you'd hope that the guy who calls himself a liberal who gets elected president wouldn't have slapped everybody in the face by putting the teddy bear up there.
At the same time, let's end on at least this little segment on a slightly positive note. In Milk, what I liked about Milk, apart from showing a piece of our history that's very important, it does show that in this country, with mass grassroots organizing, that you can actually change a policy. And I think Milk is affirming in that sense, despite the negative things we have to say right now, that there is the possibility of change, but it takes a long time. It takes personal risk. And it takes not just going to Washington. It takes massive grassroots organizing. There were boycotts there of stores that wouldn't serve gays. January 1st, 2009 is the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. That day is the day in which Batista, the former dictator of Cuba, late that night actually fled Cuba. So it's been some 50 years, an important landmark really, particularly in the history of this hemisphere, but really in the history of the world, the successful Cuban Revolution. Today we're going to bring you one of the people who've seen that revolution really since 1960, filmmaker, author, remarkable person, Sal Landau. Sal has made 3 films about Cuba. You'll hear about those. And you'll also hear Sal discuss what he considers the successes of the Cuban Revolution and what some of its problems and issues are. It's an extraordinary interview and one that we should all mark on this 50th anniversary of really the first government in this hemisphere to succeed in taking on the United States. Sal, welcome to Law and Disorder. give me some sense of, you made a bunch of movies. One of them, I remember you floated around Cuba with near Fidel or in the same Jeep or something. What movie was that?
That was Fidel.
Okay, that was Fidel. And when was that made?
We shot that in 1968. It went on public television in 69. And in 1970, we were going to open it at the Fifth Avenue Cinema, and the box office and candy counter got bombed.
Oh, my gosh. I remember that. You're right. I remember when they rolled a bomb in or something. They did something.
Yeah. And then we were going to open it in L.A., and the theater was burned down.
So let's take you back a little bit, or forward. So I think the first question I really want to ask is, as we near the 50th anniversary, what's your thinking? Did you think it would survive this long? What's the positives to you? What are the negatives? Let's start there.
Well, I think, you know, it's almost a miracle that Cuba, the revolution in Cuba, survived for 50 years, given that the strongest and most belligerent nation in the world, namely the United States, had decided, practically upon its birth, to destroy it, and did everything short of a full-scale U.S. military invasion to actually accomplish that task. And in the light of all of that, the Cuban Revolution emerges as something that is miraculous. I mean, if I was a believer in Santeria, I would say that Fidel was indeed Obatala, the supreme god, who had somehow this magical powers. Since I don't believe that, I think that it was a matter of historical circumstances and extremely clever policy on the part of the Cubans. If you look back at these 50 years, I mean, one looks at Cuba today and one finds lots of despair, especially after three brutal hurricanes trashed its agriculture and destroyed hundreds of thousands of homes. But today, Cubans are, you know, you see them hanging on a street in the middle of the workday, drinking beer and listening to reggaeton on the boombox. It's not exactly a sign of high-spirited socialist morality. In fact, there's a lot of apathy that I've gathered, you know, over my last visits, and I've been there almost every year at least once.
Since what year, Sal?
Since 1960.
Oh, my gosh. So, well, let's keep on this for a second, on the apathy, and let's keep going on that issue.
You know, people are plotting to go to Florida where they still think there's some kind of paradise waiting for them. Some of them find out that that's not quite the case. I mean, some do succeed, and, you know, some end up cleaning the toilets at the Miami airport. But the point is, you know, I kept saying to myself, if somebody had come over from Europe in 1862 to the United States, and they would have said, oh, my God, this place had such promise. Look at them now slaughtering each other in the battlefields, right? That history is a strange animal, and its growth is very uneven but nevertheless combined. And, you know, the Cuban Revolution, I see it as something that was a total success in the sense that it achieved its all of its goals and then some.
Tell us what those are in your view.
So back in January 1st, 1959, the revolutionaries march into Havana. Batista's taken an airplane to Miami, and they start a new chapter. What was it like then? What were the goals that they had, and how do you explain how they were achieved?
Well, I think if one wants a comparison, one looks at today the people who Obama has appointed to his cabinet, and one looks at the people Fidel appointed to his cabinet, and they're remarkably similar. You know, he appointed the absolute pillars of the establishment. The prime minister was Miro Cardona, who was, I think, dean of the Havana Bar Association at that time. And Judge Urrutia became the president, and, you know, he had all kinds of people who had absolutely nothing to do with his plans or his politics. And he was doing this essentially so that the establishment wouldn't panic, either in Washington or in Cuba. Needless to say, he had totally ignored his cabinet once the revolutionary process had begun, and the cabinet, you know, got the idea pretty quickly and began to resign or, in fact, defect. But when I first went to Cuba, I saw in kids my age, I was 24 at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
They were running ministries. And it was creative anarchy, creative chaos. On my subsequent visits, there was definitely organization. I mean, and Fidel realizing, I think, and the other leaders realizing that they needed an agency, a group of trained, disciplined, committed people to carry out the policies who were also literate and clearly directed. And they had to choose the old Cuban Communist Party as really the agency to carry out a lot of the reforms. I mean, they had the barbudos, the bearded guys from the mountains, and they had a cadre of the underground people who had emerged as the leaders. But, you know, they had to get some organization going. And the fact that they survived, God knows how many American-based sabotage attempts. I guess you'd have to call that terrorism today. Thousands of terrorist attacks were launched from the United States. Some of them were assassination attempts against Fidel and other leaders. Some were aimed at burning down Cuban installations or bombing them or, you know, shooting teachers or militia people. The amount of terrorism was literally extraordinary. This happened before the Bay of Pigs, and it happened after the Bay of Pigs. I think you have to, you know, list the Bay of Pigs as the first real defeat that a U.S. force, because it was a U.S.-backed force, suffered, I think, in the entire history of U.S. relations.
What year was that?
That was April of 1961.
Right. And that's when Kennedy was in office, right?
Kennedy was in office. He inherited this project from President Eisenhower. They thought they would dispatch the Cuban Revolution pretty much as they dispatched the government of Colonel Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954, where the CIA led a ragtag force down there, and everybody ran away, and the army didn't fight, and Arbenz went into exile, and that was it. Poof, over, done. A guy who was, I don't know, his reforms were basically no more extreme than anything Roosevelt did in the New Deal, but he got in the way of the United Fruit Company. He dared to, you know, try to tax them on the value that they said their land was worth, by the way. Anyway, Fidel, you know, set out to realize the goals of the Cuban Revolution that had begun in the 1860s with the first War of Cuban Independence against Spain. And so the first and foremost goal was sovereignty and independence, which is, you know, essentially meant stop taking crap from the United States. And that's not something that's easy to do. The United States had been, how shall I say it, extremely intolerant of disobedience in the Western Hemisphere. Oh, for, you know, a long time, the meaning of the Monroe Doctrine had begun, and with its Roosevelt corollary at the beginning of the 20th century, had begun to mean that you do what we say or else. And anybody who dared to defy the United States was either removed from office by the Marines or overthrown by a coup backed in one way or another by the U.S. government. You know, I refer to Dominican Republic, where the Marines had to occupy the place to prevent President Bush from taking office in 1965, or Brazil, 1964, when the U.S. Embassy played a key role in organizing the Brazilian military to overthrow President João Goulart, who was an economic nationalist, dared defy the economic policies. They dealt with Chetty Jagan in Guyana. I mean, you can go on and on, you know, the coup in Chile against Allende and so on. And here Fidel stands as the man who says, disobedience is my mission. I stand for Cuban sovereignty, and Cuban sovereignty means disobedience. Second goal of the revolution was justice and equality, you know, on a relative social justice. And by mid-1960s, the Cubans had achieved that, in addition to high levels of literacy and access to health. Cuba had 6,000 doctors in 1959. In 1960, it had only 3,000. Half of its doctors had left. And most of those doctors, by the way, were in Havana. Today, Cuba has, what, 70 or 80,000 doctors.
And I think it has thousands of them in Venezuela today.
20,000 in Venezuela alone. So when you look at these, this is what Cuba achieved. But it added one, how should I say, a little gravy on top of the meal. It made Cuba actors on the world stage in many, many areas, not just militarily, where the Cubans' defeat of the South African apartheid army in southern Angola in 87 and 88 led to not just the preservation of Angolan independence and the independence of Namibia, but it also led to South Africa having to release Nelson Mandela. And if anybody wants proof of the Cuban role in that, one goes back to the news accounts when Mandela was being inaugurated as president, and he was shaking everybody's hand, the heads of state. Al Gore was sent. And then he came to Fidel, who extended his hand, and Mandela brushes the hand aside and grabs Fidel in a bear hug and says audibly to the camera, "You made this possible."
We were talking about the positives, the goals, and I actually just came back from Cuba a few weeks ago. My son just studied there for 3 or 4 months at the University of Havana. And understanding all of these goals, we had some of the same reactions that you mentioned, which is in the 80s, certainly, when there was much more view that we can change things, make this revolution better, and do that. And we didn't have that sense this time. People are, there's a certain, as you said, people out on the streets, which part of the street people I loved. I mean, there are these groups of young people, they call them emos, which means emotional, but hundreds or thousands of them, they dress in black, a little gothic looking.
Right.
That would have never been accepted 20 or 30 years ago in Cuba, but they're out there. And so how do you see Cuba today in terms of that issue? How is that going to shift or change? Can it? What's the potential?
Well, when I said before that the Cuban Revolution was a total success, I put it in the past tense. Once it succeeded, what would it do? It came up with slogans like, be like Che. Every time I would look at that slogan, I would say, what, you got to be kidding.
That was my favorite slogan back then. I remember going on a hike through the Sierra Maestra and following the path of Che, and
right.
all these kids would have these signs that said, and they would sing, Seremos como el Che, right?
I mean, right. But very few of us can be like Che.
Well, of course.
I always found it extremely intimidating to look at that slogan. You began to get a breakdown by the 1980s, even before the special period. You know, when 130,000 Cubans left the island in Mariel in April of 1980, not all of these people were counter-revolutionaries, and not all of them were people that Fidel had released from the insane asylum or the maximum security prisons, although some of them were. Some of the people were just had been trained, educated, and couldn't get jobs in their fields. It had already begun to have certain lopsided look. I mean, and today, you know, you can attest to this as well as I, you can find anywhere on the island educated Cubans who can talk to you about many, many subjects. But the guy with a degree in engineering is making pizzas.
It's a real problem. I mean, the educated people my son met at the university are extraordinary, obviously professors as well as students. But their life, they see it as limited in some way, or at least many of them
limited.
Do.
It's a small island, and it's a poor island. And they can't, having educated all these people and actually spoiled them, I think, from the time they're in the daycare centers up through their PhDs, they get it all for free. They get food. They get everything that anybody could ever want in education. Then they get out on the street and there's no jobs. Well, there's jobs, but they're not in their fields. The salary and wage structure are not just. I mean, where you have a waiter in a hotel making more money than a doctor, and it doesn't make any sense. So this is something that they're going to have to tackle. But worse than that, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cuban economy went into a total nosedive, Cubans then were left on their own. So the socialist values that they'd learned for all of those years, 30 years, all of a sudden they couldn't practice. Instead of the collective good, they had to go for me first. I've got to survive. The state, if you like, could no longer hold up its end of the social contract, which was, we will provide you with the basic needs of your life.
Now, our friends lost huge amounts of weight then. I mean, you went there. You know,
sure.
People were very thin. They couldn't get enough to eat during that 91 to 96, I guess, right in that period.
Well, so the state said, well, we can't uphold our end of the social contract, which was meeting basic needs, at least part of it. And, well, what was the return? The return is you be obedient. Essentially, you obey the laws and act like good socialist citizens. Well, it's very hard to do that when you have to buy or sell illegally in order to survive. And that's what Cuba has gone through now for about 18 years. And you're seeing the effects of it. There's a corrosive effect. And I think that now is the time they've got to institute the reforms and they've got to shape up.
What kind of reforms? What kind of things? Because, you know, now they're faced with, obviously, and we'll get to Obama and changes, but within their own structure right now, what are you thinking?
Well, the first is they've got to make their salary and wage structure much more logical and just. People hanging out on the street oftentimes are still receiving salaries, even though they're not working. Or they can accomplish in one theft a month a salary triple to what they would have to make if they were working. So they've got to deal with the wage and salary structure and make it compatible with Cuban reality, because right now it isn't, and it hasn't been for a long time. So each Cuban, or almost every Cuban, has had to have some kind of a hustle in order to get along. But given that, they all understand that they've got still, you know, for a third world country, pretty damn good access to medical care. education. They can't get evicted. They can't have their homes foreclosed on them, okay? I mean, that's every Cuban understands that. As they even skeptically read the news in Grandma, they understand that Americans are getting thrown out of their homes or fired from their jobs or their plants closed. These are rights that Cubans have that, ironically, Americans don't have. And so these are the kinds of reforms they've got to get. They've got to now make the wage-salary structure compatible. And they've got to, I think, deal with this rising level of apathy, which I've noticed in successive visits over the special period. As people glaze over now when you start to talk to them about the revolution. And I think that, basically a gerontocracy has been running the country for security reasons, and that they've got to hand the car keys over now to their middle-aged kids.
That's a great way to put it. You've always been amazing like that.
Yeah, that's true. What about the ability to form an opposition political party or an opposition newspaper?
Well, there is no ability to do that in Cuba. Those freedoms aren't freedoms in Cuba. There's no, you have no right to practice opposition politics. All of the debate has to occur inside of the Communist Party of Cuba, where I'm sure a lot of debate does occur, but a lot of it doesn't get outside of the party so that the public isn't privy to it. You can't form another party, and you can't publish a newspaper that isn't controlled by the state or the party. And I think these are minuses. And I think that when you have a highly educated population, and then they don't really have access to the Internet, and it's not just because of technology, that the population suffers, creativity suffers, and productivity suffers. So I think all of these things, Cuba has to get up to date. And part of the reason for this whole all of these security measures is the fear that somehow the United States was going to get at them. Well, I think that under George Bush, they had a certain reason to have this fear, and certainly he talked tough. But with the Obama administration, I think a lot of the pretexts or justifications for the repressive policies are going to dissolve. And I don't think any longer the United States is going to represent a military threat to Cuba. I mean, ironically, the U.S. military and the Cuban military have had really pretty good relations over the past few years. Much better than the political sectors have had.
I understand that. But what about the ultimate American goal, which is to restore capitalism and America's economic influence and really domination of Cuba? How do they prevent that?
Well, I don't think they can prevent that. That is, unless the citizenry decide to reject it. Because once that embargo is dropped, and once it, I mean, the travel ban first, and then the embargo, and a million Americans come pouring into the island with big fat wallets, the state has basically lost control of the economy. And if they can't trust the citizens to respond and back up the system that has given them these rights, the right to housing, the right to job, education, medical care, and so on, the government that has won for them, independence and sovereignty after hundreds of years, the government that has put them on the map as proud people, as the soul in the third world, try to think of a small nation without strategic resources that has played such a role in world history. This is what they've given them. Now, they've got to trust the people at this point. And it's not in the long-range future. This is coming pretty soon.
How do you square that with the experience of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe?
Well, in the Soviet Union, I think that I was there in 84. And in 2 weeks, I didn't meet one single person who supported the government. And I'm not making this up. Even people who are high officials in the government didn't support the government. In Cuba, that's not true. There's a very strong cadre of people who have understanding of what the process is and why it has to go forward. And I think there's the counter-revolution. I think Fidel was absolutely brilliant. He exported them to Florida. That's where they are. The people who are in Cuba may be angry, apathetic, cynical, and so on, but they're not counter-revolutionary. Those people are gone. Imagine if Fidel had a million-plus Cubans on the island, or Raul had, to defy his every policy. That would have made life impossible. But he had the brilliance, and the United States the stupidity, one to export and the other to import the Cuban opposition.
What are your expectations in the next 4 to 8 years for what might happen in Cuba, what the Obama administration will do? What do you see?
Well, Obama, the Obama agenda remains somewhat enigmatic, especially when it comes to a place like Latin America. I think we can look forward, certainly, to the travel ban being lifted for Cuban Americans. On the rest, it's all guessing and speculation. We don't yet know who he's going to choose for Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs. This will, of course, help determine what that policy is. I think there's very strong business pressure, both to lift the embargo and the travel ban. The Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, agribusiness, and so on, all of these are pushing to lift the restrictions. And for the first time, the President of the United States-elect will owe nothing to the right-wing Cubans in Miami. They didn't vote for him, and they didn't give him any money. 65% voted for McCain. The 35% who voted for Obama, by the way, were by and large more recent arrivals. And the dominant population of the Miami area is no longer Cuban. The Hispanic population of that area voted for Obama, while Cubans voted for McCain. That's a president who doesn't have any political or other kinds of debts to this particular constituency. So they're more isolated than ever. All of this augurs well for some positive moves. Raul Castro has offered to do basically a swap of prisoners. He'll release all of the dissidents if the United States will release the Cuban Five. That's a different question. But he got backing, strong backing, from Latin American countries. I think the key thing that people have to understand now, and maybe we need to have a massive funeral in many, many cities throughout the world, but especially in Washington, and the funeral should be for the Monroe Doctrine.
Well, give us a little more on that.
Well, it's dead.
What is it exactly? Just tell our listeners what it is.
The Monroe Doctrine was established in 1823. It was a doctrine written by John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State under President Monroe. And it said basically that the European colonial power should stay out of Latin America. By the way, there was a second clause that said the United States will stay out of Europe. But nobody ever remembers that one. Anyway, everybody laughed at the Monroe Doctrine because the United States had neither an army nor a navy to enforce any of this stuff. But with the Roosevelt corollary is the Monroe Doctrine, which came about almost 80 years later, the United States began seriously to militarily enforce this doctrine, not so much to keep Europe out, but to use that as a pretext to intervene in Latin America. And as such, 50 years ago, and if you look at it this way, with, at the time of the Cuban Revolution, the United States was all-powerful and all-dominant. Nobody dared challenge its hegemony. In the OAS, everybody voted with the U.S., as they did in the U.N., the Latin American countries. And Fidel Castro stands as the symbol, not just of disobedience, but as the prime slayer of this doctrine. Now, was it a few weeks ago, President Lula of Brazil held a meeting of Latin American and Caribbean leaders. He didn't even invite the United States, and he made policies, and they attacked the United States. And Washington was humbled.
I saw that. The only country that didn't show up was Colombia, right?
Yes, and he made an excuse. He said the vice president.
Right.
But even Colombia is cooperating with this. And, you know, and the United States pays them $5 billion a year for obedience. You know, I guess Uribe needs some, renewed obedience training. Anyway, it's a different world. Bush sent the Fourth Fleet as a show of power, 8 months ago. All the editorials in Latin America laughed at him.
I don't recall this, but any kind of reminiscences about Fidel, or I don't know if you ever met Che, but either one or both.
Well, I met Che once briefly, but I mean, my experience with Fidel Castro is that this was one of the most, is and was, one of the most important political leaders of the 20th and even into the early 21st century, that he led a country into changing the history of Southern Africa, played a huge role in changing the nature of the Western Hemisphere and the relations of Latin America to the United States. And he stood as the man who showed you can make history if you have will, organization, and the people behind you. This is what Castro showed for, and he's now going to outdo, I hope, 50 years, 10 U.S. presidents, all of whom tried to get rid of him. This is, you know, my measure of a man of indomitable will and vision. He was a brilliant Machiavelli in the sense that he was able to survive, and he continues to be a Don Quixote on the other hand.
Well, Saul Lindo, this is fabulous. We'd love to come back to you at some point again, but I really, your work over the years, I'm going to tell one story, which was your Nicaragua story, which I still, it's my strongest memory of you. You were giving a talk, and you were saying why the Nicaraguan Revolution, Sandinista Revolution, was opposed, and he said, you know, that gave me a scene from some cowboy where a guy has his hand on his son's shoulder and he's looking out at like 10,000-acre wheat farm or cattle ranch, and he puts his arm on his son's shoulder and he said, "Son, someday all this will be yours." And then you said, you know, in Nicaragua, no one can say that to their son any longer. Do you remember that, Saul?
Yes, it was John Wayne and Montgomery Clift in Red River.
Yeah. Well, it's one of, I was so moved by it, and it was such a meaningful story.
People can get DVDs now of my various Cuba films.
Run down the list right now before we close.
And how to get them.
Right.
Okay, Fidel.
What year?
We filmed in 68. Cuba and Fidel, a short film, 1974. And The Uncompromising Revolution, which was on public television in 1990.
And how do people get those DVDs, Saul?
They write to roundworldproductions@gmail.com.
Saul Landau, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, both of you.
Thanks, Saul. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Eight alleged leaders of the Republican National Convention protest organization called the RNC Welcoming Committee have been charged under the 2002 Minnesota Patriot Act with conspiracy to riot in furtherance of terrorism. The RNC eight may each face up to 7.5 years in prison for alleged roles in the RNC protest activities. The charges against them follow a year's worth of investigation by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department with coordination of state and federal agencies that had infiltrated and collected information on the group. Today we talk with attorney Gina Berglund with the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Gina, welcome to Law and Disorder. Gina, tell us, we understand that there have been eight people victimized for their activity at the Republican National Convention. Tell me what they're charged with and, you know, what's at stake here?
The RNC 8, as they've dubbed themselves, or been dubbed, were arrested shortly before the convention opened, and they were charged then with conspiracy to riot in the second degree in furtherance of terrorism, which is a felony. They have lived with those charges for quite a few months and just recently learned that they've been charged under three new felonies: conspiracy to commit riot in the second degree, conspiracy to commit criminal damage to property in furtherance of terrorism, and conspiracy to commit criminal damage to property. So while it may seem more onerous that they're facing more charges, these are lesser charges, and it signals that the Ramsey County attorney probably believes they didn't have the evidence to prevail on the original charge. Nonetheless, this scattershot approach will make it easier for Ramsey County attorney to make at least one of the charges stick.
I'm interested in this fact that there is a terrorism charge. What? I don't understand that.
About a year or so after 9/11, the Minnesota legislature passed a statute, kind of a mini Patriot Act, as some people call it, that allows for enhancement of sentences if the crime can be viewed as terrorism. So it definitely requires the county attorney to prove quite a few elements to get there. But if they are they are facing a terrorism enhancement, if the Ramsey County attorney ends up prevailing on the terrorism enhancement, they will have to serve more time in prison. At this point, with all these charges piled on, if they say the Ramsey County attorney won on all of them, they could be facing over 20 years in prison.
Can you just say who these people are and what they allegedly were doing that got them into this fix?
Sure. They were members of the RNC Welcoming Committee, an anti-authoritarian anarchist group. And they did not plan protests, but openly and publicly organized to welcome out-of-town protesters. They provided meeting spaces, housing, and food, logistical ordinary support for people who wanted to come to the RNC and have First Amendment protests on the street. They organized very openly and publicly. They issued press releases. They had a website. They went around the country and told people about their plans to provide this kind of support. And they weren't hiding at all. They never were hiding. And now, even though that it was an open political organization, they are now facing felony charges. We believe that this is definitely political prosecution.
Well, Gina, what does this have to do? I can see the conspiracy because they're going to say that they talked amongst themselves and therefore they conspired. But what does this have to do with terrorism?
You know, I don't think it does myself. I don't believe it's terrorism. I think the way that Ramsey County Sheriff Fletcher saw it and why he wanted Susan Gertner, our Ramsey County attorney, to charge it out as terrorism is because it's political. Any kind of so-called violence, whether it's property damage or other kinds of blockading that could disrupt other people's First Amendment rights, if that can be viewed as political, then I guess you can enhance it with terrorism.
I think you said it, or at some point in a release or something, that the Minnesota laws are based on the terrorism provision of the Patriot Act?
It's often dubbed the Mini Patriot Act. It's a really very short statute. It's about 10 lines long, whereas the USA Patriot Act is, as we know, hundreds of pages.
No, but the terrorism part, that part, I'm not familiar with Minnesota law, but I know the Patriot Act provision pretty well. And that's a terrorism law that essentially has, I think there's three elements. One is that you violate a state or federal law. The second is that you make a political demand. And the third is that you endanger human life. And I remember writing at the time about that means that when I used to do this occasionally, sit down in the middle of the street and block traffic, the political demand was free Haitian refugees or whatever it was, you could today be charged with terrorism because if an ambulance was going by and couldn't get to the hospital on that street, that conceivably could be endangering human life. So that's the Patriot Act one. I assume Minnesota is doing something similar.
And the Minnesota is similar, except that somehow Minnesota legislature managed to include property damage.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Not only danger to human life, but property damage. This statute passed under the cloak of night. It was thrown into another bill. No one really knew what was happening when it was passed.
Was there property damage in Minneapolis that they're trying to link up?
Yes, there were a few plate glass windows broken. One department store window was broken. There were some police cars that were damaged, windows broken out, maybe some dents. One protester is alleged to have dropped a sandbag off of an overpass onto a delegate bus.
But of course, this is after the arrest, right? These people were arrested before the RNC, right?
That's right. No property damage had occurred before these people were arrested. These people are arrested for conspiracy to riot or conspiracy to damage property.
What I can't get over is your first point, which is really strong. When I described the Patriot Act, I said, well, even that's outrageous. Like, I'm sitting in the middle of a street. That's endangering human life. That's absurd. But to say that property damage should be included as an act of terrorism— and apart from the fact that none had occurred at their arrest, the whole thing is just like built on a house of cards.
Well, yeah. We believe that's the case as well. And we believe that the RNC 8 will prevail in the end and be acquitted, or the charges will be dismissed. So nonetheless, this is a long-term defense. It's going to take thousands of dollars to defend against these crimes. In the meantime, people who would like to be organizing politically are instead having to organize for their criminal defense.
And
a lot of other people have their free speech chilled because they think, well, if this Ramsey County attorney Susan Gertner prevails here in throwing terrorism charges against political organizers, what does that mean for the future of political organizing?
Absolutely key. You know, when we've covered the RNC on this program a couple of times already, you know, friends of ours who were out there, et cetera, what the police had done, like the RNC in New York, the one thing that was significant about Minneapolis for us is that they're charging people with terrorism. And that has a chilling effect, as you said, that is incredible. I agree with that. I think that's really serious.
What kind of support are you getting in Minnesota and around the country for this? And how can people that listen to Law and Disorder help you?
Fabulous. Yeah, the RNC8 does have their own website, www.rnc8.org. The National Lawyers Guild here, several attorneys in the chapter are representing RNC8 defendants. And as well, we have an evidence project that the National Lawyers Guild is working on for the people facing misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. That's more important for them. And so, you know, to support us, definitely visit RNC8 website and find out more about how you can support us, whether it's financially or otherwise. I encourage people just to stay abreast of what's happening, and they also need political support. So writing letters, letting them know that you're behind them. They've received support from all over the country, all over the world. People have been stepping up and expressing support to the RNC8 in all kinds of ways, whether words of support or financial support or all of the above. They are receiving a lot of support, and this buoys their spirits and helps them through this very difficult period. But it is very onerous to be facing terrorism charges as political organizers.
Gina Berglund with the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, we thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Before you go, I want you to give very solely once more your website, and we'll link to it.
Oh, again, the website for the RNC8 is www.rnc8, that's the number 8, not written out, rnc8.org.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much.
Good luck to you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
We go now to hear excerpts from an event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. The event focused on a report written by contributing editor Scott Horton. A panel of legal experts discussed the methods available to a democracy for reckoning with the legacy of human rights abuses. We'll hear from Elizabeth Holtzman, author of The Impeachment of George W. Bush.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be part of this very distinguished panel. There are some real heroes on this panel, and I appreciate the work of Harper's in bringing us together and the work of everybody here today. Let me just make a few points. Accountability is important for reasons that have already been stated. Let me just give another one, which is that it's required under the Geneva Conventions. Under the Geneva Conventions, we are responsible for bringing to justice those who violated them. Now, of course, Mr. Bush junked the Geneva Conventions, but I believe that the President of the United States, when he takes the oath of office, treaties are the law of the land, that the President is responsible for carrying out the Geneva Conventions. So it's not a situation where we can just move on. Okay, and I just want to make one other point, brief point, which as the only prosecutor on this platform, the idea that you need torture to get appropriate information is not accurate. We handle murders, rapes, robberies every day in New York City and around this country. We don't get the information to solve these crimes by beating it out of people. We do it through smart detective work, and we do it through careful investigations. And the idea that we can handle local crimes without torture, but crimes, foreign crimes that are committed against us abroad or elsewhere, crimes of war, can't be solved in the same way is just absurd and nonsensical. And you've seen some of the statements of the FBI on that score. I think it's really important for us not to get caught in this trap of the ticking clock because when you have a serial rapist or a serial murderer, you've got a ticking clock too. May not be a lot of people, but it's someone else's life. And we manage to deal with that every single day without torturing people in this country. Let me just go on to what our options are. I just want to include, since I wrote a book about impeachment, that impeachment is theoretically, it's theoretically an option because a person can be impeached after he or she has left office. There is a precedent for that, but I don't think that it's likely to happen. So I'm just going to raise that with you, but pass it by quickly. I don't know what's going to happen with pardons. I was involved in questioning President Ford about the pardon of Richard Nixon, which cost him his election. I did a little bit of research that time into pardons. I do not believe that a president can issue a pardon against himself, a pardon of himself, because it would be corrupt use of the pardon power. And I don't believe the president can issue pardons for any reason other than mercy. In other words, if it's to keep his Confederates quiet or to reward them for helping him in some way that's nefarious, I think there's some serious questions about that. So I believe that no matter what pardons are issued, there will still be an opportunity for the criminal justice system to work. I'm sure Michael and others will say much more about the criminal justice system here, but I just want to focus on two statutes which can be used for prosecutions. Obviously, this conversation is narrowed to the issue of torture. There are many other areas that we could explore. Congressman Nadler alluded to one under the FISA Act, but there are other areas in which criminal conduct may have been engaged in by this members of this administration and high-level members of this administration. I'm just going to focus on the issue of torture. There's one statute called the Anti-Torture Act. That's not its formal name. It doesn't have a real name, but it carries out the Convention Against Torture. The important thing about that statute is not only that it makes it a U.S. crime, not a foreign crime, but a U.S. crime, a U.S. felony prosecutable in U.S. courts right here in the good USA. It makes that a crime, but it also, if death results in the torture of anybody, there's a death penalty, which means there is no statute of limitations, which means that if this president doesn't want to prosecute, and the next president doesn't want to prosecute, and the next president doesn't want to prosecute, but somewhere down the line, as long as these people are alive, they can be prosecuted and brought to justice. So that's number one. Number two is the War Crimes Act of 1996. That, I would have said, would have been the second statute under which prosecutions could take place in our country. It makes it, enforces the Geneva Conventions, and makes it a federal crime, again, a federal crime prosecutable in federal courts in the United States of America to violate certain provisions of the Geneva Conventions. Now, why am I raising this statute? Not because I, Liz Holtzman, found this statute. No, I give Alberto Gonzalez full credit. Because he understood that this statute posed real problems for the administration. The War Crimes Act carries out the Geneva Conventions, and therefore, you don't have to show torture. A prosecution under the Anti-Torture Act, the President of the United States, or the Secretary of Defense, or Mr. Gonzalez, or anybody who participated in that could say, wasn't torture. You know, I was told waterboarding wasn't torture. So, I mean, what am I supposed to do? I was listening to my lawyers, not torture. I don't know whether that defense would work. But under the War Crimes Act, there's no such defense because it basically makes it a crime to deal in an inhumane, cruel, and an inhuman way with detainees. So whether waterboarding is torture or not is irrelevant under the War Crimes Act because there's no question that it is cruel and inhuman. Okay, we don't have to deal with a definitional issue. They got it. They said, whoops, this poses a problem. In a memo to President Bush, Alberto Gonzalez said, We've got to do something to reduce the likelihood of prosecution under the War Crimes Act. They understood. And so his recommendation for avoiding War Crimes Act liability, in other words, to continue to treat detainees in an inhuman and cruel way, was to opt out of the Geneva Conventions. Guess what? We did, with respect to the members of Al-Qaeda. But then there was a little problem, because the Supreme Court in 2006 in the summer said the Geneva Conventions apply to all U.S. detainees. Whoops, they said. War Crimes Act liability. This is a problem. So what did they do? They took the War Crimes Act, and as part of the Military Commissions Act, this is very clever, while everybody was screaming and yelling about how the Military Commissions Act was taking away habeas corpus and other basic rights of detainees, the administration slipped in under the radar a provision making the War Crimes Act retroactively inoperative to its inception. Got that? Just inoperative. What we need to do, and Congress passed it. Press didn't write about it. And what we need to do is to restore that statute. Because that statute also carries a death penalty when death results in its violation, and that means there's no statute of limitations. And what that means then is, assuming no pardon, and assuming I'm right that the president can't pardon himself, that prosecutions can take place under the War Crimes Act and Anti-Torture Act throughout these people's lives, and they will never rest easy. And so our obligation, it seems to me, of critical importance, is for Congress, add to Jerry's very fine list, to add to Congress to resurrect and restore the War Crimes Act as it was before October 2006. And that will allow us, no matter what, to bring the prosecutions that need to be brought whenever they can be brought. And that's how we can assure at least some level of accountability. Thank you.
That was an excerpt from the recent event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.